Bé, una de les raons per les quals... Ben breu, eh? Una de les raons per les quals a la Càtedra estem especialment contents de tenir a Jane Goodall aquest any fent la conferència és que, com s'ha dit, ja ho ha anunciat una miqueta, Josep Ferrater Mora era una persona preocupada per la qüestió que segurament ocupa ocupa les vostres sensibilitats morals, que és la qüestió dels animals i els seus drets. Aquí hem posat també una foto, hem de girar-nos per veure si és, però aquí veureu una foto de l'any 90, fa 26 anys, on surt Josep Maria Terracabres, aquí present, llavors alcalde de Tossa, Telm Saragossa, i Josep Ferrater Mora. Josep Ferrater Mora venia a fer entrega d'un premi, ell participava d'una associació i venia a fer entrega d'un premi a l'alcalde de Tossa de Mar llavors, perquè Tossa s'havia declarat la primera ciutat antitaurina d'Espanya, no sé si del món, però s'havia declarat la primera ciutat antitaurina i protectora dels drets dels animals. Ferrater Mora es va mullar públicament, perquè tot això va sortir a la premsa, dient, senyors, aquest és un exemple a seguir, això està molt bé. No era gratuït ni barat fer una jugada com aquesta, un acte públic d'aquest. Més aviat, llavors, i segurament que aquí molts en tindreu aquesta percepció, més aviat, quan es parlava dels drets dels animals, els drets, la qüestió conservacionalista, etcètera, etcètera, a l'acadèmia, si més no, i jo ho havia sentit, molts de vosaltres també ho hauríeu sentit moltes vegades, s'escapaven riures entre els llavis o se'n feia simplement burla directa. Això ha anat canviant amb els temps. Quan Ferrater Mora va trencar una llança a favor d'aquesta causa, no era ni molt menys a zero cost, suposava un cost pel prestigi, i ell, amb el seu prestigi a Espanya, va contribuir a que la cosa canviés. Bé, una persona que va ajudar moltíssim i que va contribuir moltíssim a que Ferrater Mora tingués aquesta percepció i aquesta sensibilitat va ser la seva dona, Priscilla Kohn. La seva dona és una persona molt preocupada per la qüestió animalista, pels drets dels animals, una persona que estima moltíssim els animals. Priscilla Kohn, que també és filòsofa, i Josep Ferrater Mora van escriure un llibre l'any 81, va sortir publicat l'any 81 a Espanya, ja fa una colla d'anys, en què mitjançant aquest llibre es va introduir el que avui dia anomenem i tots coneixereu com ètica aplicada a Espanya, aquest era el títol. Llavors, molta gent, jo mateix, recordo comentaris escèptics fets per mi mateix, que existeix això de l'ètica aplicada, tot ètica. Bé, la qüestió és que aquest llibre va obrir tot un camp que fins llavors no era treballat, que fins i tot, com us dic, en algunes qüestions despertava més aviat escepticisme que no pas res més, va contribuir a obrir aquest camp, i no només això, sinó que amb el prestigi de Ferrater Mora, amb, diríem, l'afany i la bona feina de Priscilla Kohn, van ajudar a consolidar com un camp a treballar. Ells són pioners, Josep Ferrater Mora i Priscilla Kohn van ser pioners de la causa, diguem-ho així, animalista i ambientalista a Espanya, sens dubte, almenys en el camp acadèmic. Bé, avui tenim la sort, ha vingut directament de Filadèlfia, té 82 anys, com la Jane Goodall, jo no sé què va passar aquell any, però van trencar el motllo. Ha vingut directament des de Filadèlfia per donar veu a Jane Goodall, donar-li la veu i per agrair-vos la presència a tots. Sisplau, un aplaudiment.
Must admit, I'm so very, very happy to be here and so terribly excited to be introducing Jane Goodall that I don't know what to say, but anyhow, she needs no introduction. But it may seem strange that I see many similarities between my husband and Jane Goodall. I mean, it's strange for someone who wrote a massive four-volume dictionary of philosophy that is known all over, and a lady who did so much to advance our knowledge about chimpanzees, but there are a lot of similarities, because in my husband's original philosophy, which he wrote about a theory of continuity, the continuity of all life, of other things too, but particularly of all life. And I think that Jane Goodall used the expression interconnectedness, between life. In other words, traditionally, people were considered humans as superior, more important, better, smarter, etc., etc. And sometimes they said they're the only animal in the world that lived, that made tools, etc., etc. And Jane Goodall gave the lie to that. So this notion of interconnectedness and continuity is common to both of them. And I think, I just want to tell you one little, very short story about Jose and I, and I think Jane Goodall will appreciate it. We were walking one day near the cathedral, and it was a lot of people walking around there. Sailors, very tall young men with girlfriends and heavy, heavy boots. And as we were walking, a little tiny baby rat came out from someplace under the cathedral, near the cathedral. And before I could see what was really going to happen, one of the young men kicked the rat, the little baby. It flew up in the air and landed with a thump. And it obviously hurt one of its legs and tried to run away on three legs as fast as it could be. Of course, my Spanish vanished. I couldn't think of a word to say. And I tugged on my husband's arm and I said, "Do something, do something." And he hadn't seen it, but he saw this little animal running away. And he rushed up and put himself in front of these four young men and said something so strange that I remember it perfectly. He said, "You wouldn't do that if it was a lion." And I thought, what a strange thing to say. But obviously what he was talking about is might does not make right, right? And he was against all kinds of violence. And it just is a typical story of him, of his, the way he acted and how he encouraged me and stood up for everything I believed in with animals. And later on, not only did he talk intellectually about animals, he wrote some famous essays against bullfighting for which he was very heavily criticized. But he did it anyhow, he wanted to. And he emphasized the notion that the difference between animals, various different kinds of animals, is a difference of degree, not a difference of kind. We're not a different kind of substance or a different being. You know, they were just differences of degree, just as there are differences between individual animals and species of animals. I think that Jane Goodall would like the story of the little rat, and I think she would agree that might does not make right. And so he saw this not just as loving animals or even respecting them, but as a whole thing. And as far as I'm concerned, the world would be a much better place if everybody felt that respect. So I'm very anxious to hear what Jane Goodall has to say, and I don't want to take up any more of your time. So thank you for coming. We appreciate it so much.
Well, thank you, Priscilla, and thank you for the story about the little rat. Actually, rats are incredibly intelligent, and I'm not going into this, but I know the rats, the giant forest rats, who've been taught to detect landmines in Tanzania, and they're now working in many different countries detecting landmines. They can also detect the earliest signs of TB, which is a big problem in Africa, and they can do it before the actual medical tests show that TB is there. So that's rats for you. Now, enough about rats. We're not here to talk about rats. I want to do a greeting that I usually start my talks with, most especially for the people who are in the overflow rooms who are not actually with us. And this is the distance greeting of the chimpanzee. Simply means this is me, this is Jane. And actually an extremely important call because every chimpanzee has his or her own special voice. So when you hear that call, you know who is calling. And because the chimpanzees travel around sometimes alone, sometimes in small groups, it's very important for them to be able to maintain contact over distance, to know where everybody is. But I actually want to go back to the beginning. I want to spend a few minutes thinking about how is it possible that Jane is standing here talking to you and going around the world to other groups of people who all seem to want to hear what I'm saying. And I think I must go back to the fact that I was very lucky in my mother. We can't choose our parents, at least it doesn't seem likely, does it? And I just got lucky. I was born loving animals, and my mother always supported that love. I was just 1.5 when she came into my room one evening, and I'd taken a whole lot of wriggling earthworms with me, and of course a lot of earth with them. And so many mothers would get angry, how dare you mess up your bed like this? But she just said quietly, they need the garden or they'll die. And so we took them back. And a story I want to share, some of you may know it, but there's a very special reason for telling this story. It happened when I was 4.5. We lived in London, not so many animals there, not really. Of course, we had a dog and there were birds and things. But on this occasion, we went to stay for a holiday on a farm in the country, in the days when farms were real farms and cows and pigs were out in the fields. And I was given a job to help collect hens' eggs. And in those days, again, the hens pecked around in the farmyard. They were supposed to lay their eggs in these little wooden hen houses where they also slept at night. And I would go around the hen houses, and if there was an egg, pop it in my basket. But I don't remember this. I began asking everybody, but where does the egg come out of the hen? Because here's the egg. I couldn't see a hole like that. And nobody answered to my satisfaction. And what I do remember is one day seeing a hen, and she's going into the hen house. I can remember she was brown. And thinking, ah, she's going to lay an egg, and crawling after her, which was a big mistake. And she flew out with squawks, I suppose, fear. And 4.5 years old, but I remember, I realized no hen will lay an egg here. This is a frightening place. So I went into an empty hen house and waited, and waited, and waited, which was fine for me. But my poor family didn't know where I was. And they were out searching. And they even called the police. Finally, my mother sees this excited little girl rushing towards the house. So many mothers would have grabbed that child. How dare you go off without telling us? Don't you dare do it again, which would have killed the excitement. But she sat down to hear this wonderful story of how a hen lays an egg. So the reason I tell that story, isn't that the making of a little scientist? The curiosity, asking questions, not getting the right answer, deciding you have to find out for yourself, making a mistake, not giving up, and learning patience. It was all there. And if I'd had a different kind of mother, that scientific curiosity might have been crushed, and I might not be standing here. She very wisely found books for me to read about animals, thinking I would then learn to read more quickly, which apparently I did. I loved books. A lot of young people today can't imagine a world without television, but when I was growing up, there was no TV, and of course, there were none of these electronic gadgets either. So we learned from books, from listening to our elders, and from experience out in the world. We had very, very little money. By the time I was 10 years old, World War II was raging across Europe. My father had gone off, he'd joined up. And we'd gone to live with my grandmother. And so little money, but loving books. Mostly they came from the library. But there were also secondhand bookshops, and I would spend hours looking in there. And 10 years old, I found this little book. I still have it. I could just afford it. And it was called Tarzan of the Apes. I read it from cover to cover. And of course, I fell passionately in love with this glorious lord of the jungle. And what did Tarzan do? He married the wrong Jane. Yeah. At any rate, that was when my dream began. I will grow up, go to Africa, live with wild animals, and write books about them. Everybody laughed at me. Africa was very far away then. There were no planes going back and forth with tourists. It was known as the Dark Continent, dark with mystery. And as I've said, we had very little money. And worst of all, I was just a girl. Girls didn't get to do that sort of thing. Jane, get real. Dream about something you can achieve. But not my mother. She said to me what I now say to young people around the world, particularly young people living in disadvantaged communities. She said, if you really want this thing, you're going to have to work really hard and take advantage of every opportunity and never give up. So, left school, no money for university, just money for secretarial course, got a job in London. And then came the opportunity, a letter from a school friend whose parents had moved to Kenya, and she invited me for a holiday. I went home, worked as a waitress, jolly hard work, by the way, serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And eventually, after 4 or 5 months, I'd saved up enough wages and salary and tips to get a return fare to Africa. And it was by boat, because that's the way one traveled then. So I was 23 years old when I waved goodbye to family, friends, and country, and set off on this amazing adventure. And it was 3 weeks at sea. The boat had to go around Cape Town because the Suez Canal was closed because Britain was having a silly little war with Egypt. It was much more exciting for me to spend 3 weeks at sea and get to see the different landscapes on the shore when we were near enough. We landed a few times. It was magic. Anyhow, I finally got to stay with my friend, and I was told about somebody called Dr. Lewis Leakey. And I was told, if you're interested in animals, you should meet Lewis. So I went to see him, made an appointment. He was curator of the Natural History Museum in Nairobi, just to talk about animals. And he took me all around and he asked me so many questions. I'd followed my mother's advice. I'd gone on learning about African animals. I'd spent hours in the Natural History Museum in London. And so I could answer many of his questions. And although I hadn't gone looking for a job with him, I left with a job. And he said I could be his secretary assistant. And that led to so many amazing things. I got to go on one of his safaris looking for the fossilized remains of early man. That's what he was famous for. He was a paleontologist. And being out there in an Africa that was very different from today, out there where all the wild animals still roamed, being allowed to wander in the evenings after the hard day's work, out with one other young English girl. And one evening we met a rhino. It was about the distance of this platform. And luckily the wind was going from him to us and he ran off in the other direction. And one evening it was a young male lion. And he followed us for, I would say, twice the length of this whole auditorium, which was a bit scary, but very exciting. And I think it was that evening around the campfire that Lewis decided that I was the person he'd been looking for to go and study chimpanzees. His theory was that he was digging up fossils of our primate, of our ancient human ancestors. And from those fossils, you can deduce a lot from the teeth wear, roughly what sort of diet they had, from the shape of the bones, the sort of posture they had, and from their stone tools, roughly what they were doing, but not behavior. Behavior doesn't fossilize. And he argued that if I could find behavior that was the same or similar in chimpanzees today living in the wild with the Stone Age ancestors that he was digging up, then maybe that's how they behaved. Maybe. That's why he sent me out. It took a year before I could actually start. First of all, where was the money coming from? Young girl, untrained, straight from England. I actually had to go back to England to wait. And eventually a wealthy American businessman said, okay, here's money for 6 months. We'll see how she does. Second problem, at that time, what is Tanzania today was Tanganyika. It was part of the crumbling British Empire. And the authorities were not prepared to take responsibility for this young girl. Eventually, because Lewis never gave up, they said, oh, all right, but she must have a companion. So who volunteered to come? For the first 4 of those 6 months, it was that same amazing mother. And I mean, it was fine for me to have one ex-army tent with, you know, just a ground sheet on the floor, and you tied up the flaps and air could come in, but so spiders and snakes and centipedes, which was all right for me, but poor mum. And we had a tin plate and a tin mug each. We had a cook as well. And she was down there in the camp, and I was up in the hills every day before daylight and coming back in the evening. So she was alone all day. But she played a very important role, because in those first weeks, actually months, the chimpanzees would take one look at this peculiar white ape and run away. And although I'm living in my dream world, I know that if I don't see something exciting before the money runs out, that's the end. And so it was great that when I got back, sometimes dejected in the evening, there was Mum to point out that I was actually learning more than I realized. I'd found this peak from which I could look out over 2 separate valleys with my binoculars. I was learning how the chimps move around in these small groups, sometimes gather together when there's a delicious fruit suddenly ripe. I was learning how at night they would climb the trees and bend over the branches to make sleeping platforms or nests to spend the night. I was learning something about the different foods they were eating. I would watch them, and then when they'd gone, I would climb down and collect it and press it, and it was going off to the herbarium in Nairobi. And I was learning something about their calls. So she boosted my morale, and it was really sad that she had to leave just before the breakthrough observation. And that was when, one never-to-be-forgotten day, I looked through the vegetation and I saw a chimpanzee crouched over a termite mound. And I saw a black hand reach out and break off a grass stem and push it down into the termite mound and pull it carefully out and pick off the termites hanging on with their jaws. And I saw him pick a leafy twig. And before he could use that as a tool to fish for termites, he had to strip off the leaves. That's the beginning of tool making. And as was said earlier, it was thought at that time, this is 1960, that humans and only humans used and made tools. In fact, we were defined as man the toolmaker. So that when Leakey heard, I sent him a telegram, and he sent back his famous response, well, now we shall have to redefine tool, redefine man, or accept chimpanzees as humans. It was very exciting in that this is what brought into the picture the National Geographic Society. They agreed not only to fund the research on after the first money ran out, but they also sent a filmmaker, a photographer, Hugo van Lawick, who became my first husband. And it was Hugo's images, Hugo's film, because he was now covering all the information, and more information was coming in as the chimpanzees began to lose their fear of me. And it was these images that took the chimpanzees into the living rooms and the hearts and the minds of people around America and then around the world. So all of this was because I'd seen chimpanzees using and making tools. And the first chimpanzee who demonstrated this to me was a very recognizable individual. He had a beautiful white beard, and I'd named him David Greybeard. And because he lost his fear before the others, sometimes I would approach a group, get a bit too close by a mistake coming through the vegetation. And if David was in the group, they were ready to run, but he just sat there. And they would look from him to me and back. And I suppose they thought, well, she can't be so frightening after all. So gradually I got to know them with all their vivid individual personalities. And I got to know more and more as the months turned into years about the way that they behave. And if I now look back, and we're in our 56th year of the study at Gombe now, and if I look back over all these years, I think the thing that is most striking is how like us they actually are. We know today far more about the biological similarity than we knew back then. We know that the DNA of humans and chimpanzees differs by only just over 1%, and the main difference is the expression of the genes, I'm told. We know the similarity in the composition of the blood and the structure of the immune system. We know that the anatomy of the brain is almost identical, it's just that our brain is bigger. I wasn't really interested in those aspects. I was interested in the behavior. You can watch a group of chimps, and sometimes, even if you know nothing about them, you can have a pretty good idea, because their non-verbal communication is so like ours. They kiss, they hug, they pat one another, they hold hands, they swagger when they want to intimidate another, they shake their fist, they may wave a branch as like a club. They beg for food, they beg for reassurance. And in all these ways, these postures and gestures, bowing and crouching, they show them in the same situation as we do. They mean the same sort of thing. The males are the dominant in chimp society. They're larger, they're more aggressive. They patrol the boundaries of a territory, they're very territorial. They compete with one another for social dominance, and different males have different strategies. And it turns out that the ones who get to the top by using their brains, such as forming an alliance with another male before challenging the current top-ranking individual, they last longer than those who are big and strong and bullying and charge in and defeat the previous alpha through aggression. They don't last so long, maybe 2 years. Whereas the male who lasted longest was a very astute, intelligent male, and he lasted 10 whole years as dominant, which is pretty unusual, I think. From the beginning, I was most fascinated by families. And the mother doesn't have her first baby till she's about 13. She then has one child approximately every 5 years. It's a very long period of childhood dependency when the infant is riding the mother's back, suckling, although less frequently, and sleeping in her nest at night. And when the next child is born, the elder one doesn't leave, oh no. The elder one is still emotionally dependent on the mother, still stays with her for at least the next 3 years. And so the bond between offspring and mother gets ever closer, and the bond between the brothers and sisters develops and gets closer. And these bonds can last throughout life. We think that the long childhood is important for chimpanzees, as for humans, in relation to social learning. And the importance of that early experience in chimpanzees is shown again and again. There are good mothers and bad mothers. And the good mothers who are tolerant but can impose discipline, who are affectionate and playful, above all, who are supportive, just like my mother, they tend to grow up and be more successful. So the females will be better mothers themselves, and the males are likely to climb higher in the dominance hierarchy. And those with the less good mothers don't do as well. And this long childhood seems to be important because just like our children, chimpanzee children have an awful lot to learn. And as we come up the animal kingdom in levels of complexity, we find that there is more and more individual learning in the life history. And chimpanzees learn by carefully watching the adults in their community, particularly the mother and siblings, and then you see them imitating and practicing. One definition of human culture is behavior that's passed from one generation to the next through observation, imitation, and practice. So we can say that chimpanzees have primitive culture too. And in fact, now that chimps are being studied in different parts of Africa, we know that in these different study sites, there are different objects used for different purposes. And we can describe these as primitive cultures. At Gombe, they use different objects for 9 different purposes. And in other areas, we're adding to our understanding of their intelligence. So I think it was a big shock for me when I realized that I thought chimps were like us, but nicer. And then I realized that like us, they have a dark, violent, and brutal side, and they're capable of extreme aggression, even a kind of primitive war, and they kill. So that mostly we see this when the males are patrolling the territory, and they're looking for sight or sound of individuals from a neighboring social group. And if they see such an individual away from the main group, they will give chase, and if they catch that individual, they will subject him or her to a very brutal gang attack, and that individual will die of wounds inflicted. Fortunately, just like us, the chimpanzees also have a loving, compassionate, and altruistic side. As we see when a mother dies and her infant will be adopted by an older brother or sister, if there is an older brother or sister. And by the way, the males make very good caregivers. But one occasion at Gombe, little Mel was just 3.5 years old. And he lost his mother. He had no older brother, no older sister. But to our amazement, he was adopted by a 12-year-old adolescent male, unrelated. And that male, Spindle, waited for little Mel in travel, let him ride on his back, shared food when Mel begged, drew him into his night nest so that the two slept curled up together, and most amazing, would run in to protect little Mel if he got too close to the big males when they're socially excited and charging back and forth in these dramatic displays, when they may pick up and hurl a rock, and if an infant gets in the way, may pick it up and hurl it. And the mother's job is to make sure this doesn't happen. Spindle took on that role too, even though he often got beaten up because adolescents are great scapegoats. So it's pretty clear, isn't it? I mean, it was very clear that there isn't this sharp line that was presumed at the time that Priscilla talked about. It's not a difference of kind, it's a difference of degree. Yet when I got to Cambridge University in 1961, because Lewis Leakey told me I had to get a degree, that he wouldn't always be around to get money for me, and there was no time to mess about with a BA, he said, he'd found me a place at Cambridge University to to do a PhD, the eighth person in the history of the university to do a PhD without a BA. And I was extremely nervous. He'd sent me a telegram saying I was to do a PhD in ethology. I didn't even know what ethology meant. Remember, I'd never been to college. And imagine how I felt when I got there and was told by the professors that I'd done everything wrong. I shouldn't have given the chimpanzees names. They should have had numbers. That was science. And I couldn't talk about them having personalities or minds capable of problem solving, certainly not emotions, because those were unique to us, as Priscilla said earlier. But fortunately, I'd had a wonderful teacher when I was a child, and that teacher had taught me, absolutely, the professors are wrong. That teacher was my dog, Rusty. You can't share your life in a meaningful way with a dog, a cat, a horse, a rat, I don't care what animal it is, a bird, and not know that, of course, animals have personalities, minds, and feelings. But it was because, I think, of the biological similarities between us and chimps, because some of the professors came and watched the Gombe chimpanzees and were amazed. And gradually, it was this information that began to break down that rigid, scientific, incorrect attitude. And then information was coming in from complex creatures like elephants and dolphins. And so gradually science became more accepting and realized, yes, we're part of this amazing animal kingdom. We're not separated from it. And we should be proud because what a fascinating kingdom it is. And now that science is opening its mind to thinking in new ways, gosh, it's an exciting era for students now. For a long time, it was held that, well, birds can't really be intelligent. Yes, parrot owners say their birds can understand words, but that's not possible because the bird brain is structured differently. Well, actually, it was two scientists in Oxford University. They were doing something very simple. They put peanuts into a glass tube, and the birds were given a wire with a hook, and they pushed the wire down and hooked the peanut out. It was easy for them. But then one day, accidentally, the hook broke off the wire, and the birds were left with one piece of straight wire, lots of frustrated stabbing. And then one of them, using beak and foot, bent a hook, pulled out the peanut. "Ha," said skeptical scientists. "Well, that was just an accident." Well, maybe it was. But if it was, the very next day, the bird immediately made a hook, and the next day. So, it was just one bird. You can't deduce anything from that, said the scientist. Well, why was just one bird doing it? That was the female, and every time she pulled out a peanut, the male took it from her. So the moral is, if you have a wife, why bother to make a tool? If you haven't seen this afterwards, please, I beg you to do this. Google octopus and coconut shell. And if you haven't seen it, you will A, be amazed, and B, it will be give you a really good laugh. So octopus and coconut shell. At any rate, here we are learning more and more about these amazing animals. I got my PhD. I went back to Gombe. I built up a research station. I was married by then, I had a child, I had time to go out in the field, I had time to write up my scientific data, which I loved doing, time for doing some popular writing, teaching at Stanford University once a year. So why did I leave? That was my dream life. It happened very suddenly at a conference in 1986, where for the first time all the different chimpanzee scientists came together. And we had one session on conservation, and it was shocking. Every single field site showed chimpanzee numbers dropping, forests disappearing, chimpanzees caught in wire snares set by hunters, the beginning of the bushmeat trade, that's the commercial hunting of wild animals for food, shooting mothers in order to steal their babies and sell them overseas for pets, for circuses, and in those days for medical research. And we had a session on conditions in some captive situations. There was secretly filmed video of our closest living relatives in medical research labs in 5 foot by 5 foot cages surrounded by iron bars, steel bars. And maybe there for 30, 40, 50 years, chimpanzees can live to be more than 60. And I went to that conference planning to continue my wonderful life. I left as an activist. And since that time, I'm not conscious of making any decision. It just happened. And I felt I had to try and do something for the chimps. I don't know what I thought I could do, actually, but I went around different African countries where there are chimps, learning more and more about the problems faced by the chimps, setting up wildlife awareness weeks, bringing together different NGOs and people interested in conservation. And as I'm learning more and more about the problems faced by the chimps, I'm learning more and more too about the problems faced by many African people. The crippling poverty, the lack of good education and health facilities. It was late 80s when I flew over the tiny Gombe National Park. When I arrived in 1960, the forest went all the way along the eastern shore of Lake Tanganyika, curled round through Uganda, and went back westward through Central Africa, the Congo Basin, to West Africa. And when I flew over Gombe, it was a little island, a little oasis of forest, surrounded by completely bare hills. All the trees had gone, save in the really, really steep ravines where even desperate people couldn't go. And the people there, there were more of them than the land could possibly support, too poor to buy food elsewhere, struggling to survive. And that's when I realized if we don't do something to help these people, we can't even try to save the chimpanzees. And that led to our program. We called it Take Care or Takari, which began with 12 villages around Gombe. We didn't go in like so many well-meaning foreigners who want to help with a team of white people. It was a team selected of local people. They didn't even have PhDs with which to intimidate the villagers. They'd worked in NGOs in forestry and agriculture and health and so forth. And they sat down to listen to what the villagers felt we could do to help them most. Grow more food, better education, better health facilities. And that's where we started. And then we were able to introduce projects to reforest some of the slopes, to restore the flow of water in the little streams that had got clogged up by the erosion as the trees disappeared. And then we introduced what I think has been the most important, that's microcredit opportunities, particularly for women, so that they can choose environmentally sustainable small projects. During the time that we've had this program going, which is 12 years or so, almost, I think, just over 90% of all money loaned has been paid back. And the women are becoming empowered. And we provide as many scholarships as we can to keep girls in school after puberty. And it's been shown all around the world that as women's education improves, family size tends to drop. And this is desperately important because the land here cannot support an ever-growing human population. So we provide family planning information as well. And again, it's the Africans themselves, the local people, who provide all this information, not us. So successful, it's now in 52 villages. It's in areas further south where there are still wild chimpanzees who are not protected. In fact, most of Tanzania's chimpanzees are there. And the same kind of program has been introduced into other programs, other countries, such as Uganda and DRC and Congo Brazzaville and Senegal. very successful program. But as I'm, you know, learning about all of this going on in Africa, I'm realizing that not all these problems faced by the Africans, not all of them, but many of them, can be traced back to the old colonial days. People going in from other countries, taking Africa's natural resources for their own development, usually leaving the Africans poorer. And I realize that to some extent today, the big multinationals, not all of them, but many of them, are doing more or less the same thing. That's when I began traveling around Europe and then North America, South America, Asia, now the Middle East, talking about the problems we face on this planet. And you know the sort of problems I'm talking about. I'm talking about the deforestation, releasing CO2 into the atmosphere, adding to these greenhouse gases that are circling our planet and trapping the heat of the sun. We know about climate change. We know about the dead areas in the ocean where it's acidified because it's absorbed so much CO2 and it can't absorb any more. And we know about the terrible pollution of air, water, and land from industrial, agricultural, household waste. And I could go on and on. You know the problems we face today. And that brings me back to the chimps. The biggest difference, I think, between us and them, and other animals too, is this explosive development of the human intellect, possibly at least pushed in that intellectual direction because we and only we have developed the kind of language that enables us to use words, spoken, now written, to talk about things from the past, to make plans for the future, to teach our children about things that are not present, and above all, to have discussions about problems so that we can bring people with different experience together to discuss a problem and look for a solution. So why on earth has the creature with the greatest intellect that's ever walked on this planet, how is it possible we're destroying our only home? It doesn't make sense. We seem to have lost wisdom. Wisdom where you made a decision based on how will this help, how will this affect our people generations ahead? Now, how will it affect me, my family, now? What about the next shareholders meeting? What about my next political campaign? So it seems there's a tragic disconnect between this clever brain and the heart, love and compassion. And I truly believe that only when head and heart work in harmony can we achieve our true human potential. And our true human potential is huge. Not surprising, as I'm traveling around the world, learning about all this stuff and more, that I'm meeting people who seem to have lost hope. And I met many young people who seem to have lost hope. And this was very disturbing. High school students, university students, young people in their first jobs, thoughtful young people who thought about all these problems. And I began talking to them. And they all said more or less the same. We feel like this because we feel you've compromised our future and there's nothing we can do about it. Well, we have compromised their future. When I think how we've harmed this planet since I was a child, I feel deep shame and anger. But is it true there's nothing that can be done about it? This I refuse to believe. And it may be wishful thinking, but unlike many biologists, I believe we have a window of time where we can actually begin to make a difference. And this is so important for our young people to believe, because if they lose hope, then there is no hope. And equally, if the young people don't grow up to do a better job of stewardship than we have, then we may as well not bother. So this is why I began our program, the Jane Goodall Institute program, Roots and Shoots. It began with 12 high school students in Tanzania who came to my home from 9 different schools to talk about things that worried them in the world around them, in their immediate world. And they went back and talked to their friends, and we had a big meeting, and Roots and Shoots was born with the main message: every single individual matters, has a role to play, and every single individual makes a difference every single day. That means all of us. And every group chooses for itself. We don't tell them what to do, although they may take part in a campaign. But every group chooses 3 projects to make the world better. One to help people, one to help other animals, one to help the environment we all share, with a theme running through it of let's learn to live in peace and harmony between nations, between religions, between cultures, and between us and the natural world. That's what Roots and Shoots is all about. And what began with these 12 students is now in 100 countries. We've got about 100,000 active groups. They range in age from kindergarten, very strong in university, and everything in between. It's, I think, a program that is giving me a good deal of hope. So we've got a little tiny short video to show you. It was made about 7 years ago. We've advanced since then. But this gives you an idea of the kind of things the Roots and Shoots groups are doing around the world and why they give me such hope.
Some people think it's far away. Some know it's with them every day. You are the reason we found out. So thank you, star. There are no winds that can blow.
Letting lots of people know.
When they try to blow it away, is when you know it will always be there. To some, it's the truth to be a part.
Hello.
To some, it's a feeling in the heart. And when you're out there on your own, it's the way back home.
So that gives you some idea of what these young people are doing. And people always ask me, you know, do you really have hope? I've got 5 reasons for hope. Very quickly, first of all, the young people. Once they know the problems and they're empowered to take action, I'm telling you, they're changing the world even as we speak. And they're beginning to understand that when we have this choice every day as to the actions we take, if we think about the consequences of the small choices we make, what we buy, what we eat, what we wear, where did it come from? How was it made? Did it harm the environment? And it's changing the world. Second reason for hope is this brain of ours, this amazing brain. If we really get together, if we really decide we want to solve the problems, if we can get away from this crazy notion of unlimited economic development that the economists are pushing for, that is going to happen forever and ever, as far as I can see, the way they talk around the world, on a planet with growing numbers of people and finite natural resources. Doesn't make sense, really, does it? How can you have unlimited economic development? And yet we're surrounded by pressure to become consumers. It's so materialistic. We've got to buy to keep the economy growing. So it's going to grow forever and we're going to buy forever. I don't know what's going to be left to buy if that goes on too long. At any rate, our brains can solve this if we sit down and seriously think about future generations. Third reason for hope is the resilience of nature. So we can destroy a place and give it a chance, maybe some money, some help. It can once again support life. I told you about Gombe. I told you about the land around Gombe, which was totally deforested. I told you about the Tokari program that we began there. Now that the villagers trust us, they have put land aside to form a buffer between the tiny Gombe National Park and the villagers. And within 12 years, you can get 30-foot high trees. And they've set land aside that will grow trees to link the Gombe chimps with other scattered groups further to the south so that genetic exchange can take place. Chimpanzees now have 3 times more forest than they had before we began the program. And not only the trees, but the animals are coming back too. And we have trained volunteer monitors from each of 52 villages, and they're also trained in Uganda, and they're so proud. They take smartphones and iTablets, they take it out into the forest, and they record damage to the forest, like an illegally cut tree, or an illegal pit saw, or a spent cartridge. And they also record positive signs, like new trees growing, a chimpanzee nest, or a leopard paw print, and so on. And all this information goes up to a platform in the clouds, which is Global Forest Watch, and could be downloaded by village leaders and by politicians so that people know exactly what's going on. And this information is coming in from forests all around the world, and it's growing all the time. So animals on the brink of extinction can be given another chance. I did a whole book on that, and it was so exciting. Every single chapter is about an animal that wouldn't be here if it wasn't for a person or a group of people saying, I will not let this creature become extinct, or this plant, or whatever it is. The next reason for hope is the indomitable human spirit, the people who tackle the impossible and won't give up and blaze a path for others to follow or succeed themselves. Those who are struggling with physical disabilities, who are out there leading lives that inspire everybody around them. People with no legs, people with no arms, I've met them. They're amazing. And the last reason for hope, it's kind of a weird one, but social media. And last year I was part of the New York Climate Change March. And the organizers expected about 80,000 people. In fact, there were almost 400,000 people. So what was happening? Well, I was there, so I saw everybody had their little electronic gadget out, and they were doing all these tweets and Twitters and messages and all the things that you all do nowadays. And some of them were on their cell phones, so I could hear them saying, oh, come and join us. It's really great weather. There's a whole crowd of film stars here. I heard one of them saying, I've just seen Leonardo DiCaprio. I actually heard one of them saying, this is true, Jane Goodall's here. So this was happening in major cities around the world, and it is said to have been the biggest gathering of human beings around a single issue in the history of mankind. So it's this social media that can lend support to a group of people who may feel that they are alone out in the world. There's a little group of people here by the Parliament Hall here in Girona And they're there with their tents, maybe you've seen them, and they're protesting the treatment of the refugees. The first thing I saw when I arrived in Madrid was a big notice on the town hall saying, refugees welcome. And I stopped to talk to these people. And this will grow, and there will be more people, because it hurts me what we're doing to the refugees. England's just as bad. And when you meet these refugees and know the horrors they've fled from and then see the way they're treated in so many European countries, it's terrible. We worry about animal rights, but there's human rights to worry about as well. So those are my reasons for hope. And sometimes people say to me, but Jane, you know, how do you keep going? 82, you're traveling 300 days a year. What keeps you going? Well, partly it's the fact that I have to, I must, it's like a mission. Partly it's the wonderful people I meet who, like the Jane Goodall Institute staff and things like that, who keep me going. But sometimes something happens that is so unexpected, and it's like a thank you for everything. So you heard about the Mona Sanctuary here, and there are two others in Spain, actually, rescuing chimpanzees from terrible lives, Primodomus and Rainfa. And in Africa, the Jane Goodall Institute is responsible for two sanctuaries. The biggest in Africa is in the Republic of Congo, Chimponga. And it's run by two Spanish people. And this little film was taken by Fernando, the husband of Rebecca. And some of you will have seen it, but it's very short, and I want to end with this because it's one of the most amazing things that's ever happened to me. So let's see this last little piece of video. This is a really exciting moment for me. The Jane Goodall Institute's Chimponga Chimpanzee Rehabilitation Center in the Republic of Congo has for years been caring for infants whose mothers were killed, mostly for the illegal bushmeat trade. Many of them are now fully grown. Recently, we acquired three large forested islands on the beautiful Quilu River, where we can release many of the chimpanzees from our overcrowded center. In here is Wunda, and she nearly died, but thanks to Rebecca, she came back from the dead, and here she is about to come out into this paradise. She's the 15th chimpanzee to get her freedom here. And we hope ultimately to have about 60 on the island. Today is the first time I've met Wunda. I talked to her on the boat, trying to reassure her. She must have wondered what was happening. None of us could predict exactly what she would do once the cage door opened. It was a very, very touching moment. One of the most amazing things that's ever happened to me. The warmth of her embrace is something I shall never forget. For Wunda and all the other chimpanzees we're working to bring here, Chinzula Island will provide a wonderful forest home where they will be cared for and safe. So that was an amazing moment. And to end off that story for the moment anyway, it's now a very exciting thing happened. Wunda has just had a baby, All the chimps have implants for birth control because we've got 165. We cannot afford babies to be born in the sanctuary. They're still coming in from outside. But Wunda's went wrong, and we're really glad. She's a wonderful mother. She's with a group of 30 now. She's the dominant female, and her baby has been called Hope. So I wanted to end on that note of hope and thank all of you for coming. I especially want to thank Federico up there, being your Spanish voice. He must be very exhausted now, and he's a fantastic executive director of JGI Spain, and along with Ferran has built up the program. So again, thank you all for coming.
Bé, només moltes gràcies, simplement, no és que continuï, és simplement que la gent, ell abans ha anunciat, s'ha acabat, ell abans ha anunciat que la gent que volguéssiu fer una foto o signar algun llibre per signar, ella s'ho faria. Jo només us demanaria una cosa, som molta gent entre aquesta sala i les que hi han, que els que vulgueu fóssiu molt ràpids, fóssim molt ràpids. Les càmeres amb flash no li agraden, té sensibilitat als ulls pels flashos, per tant, sisplau, sense flashos, i que anéssim en aquest sentit. Vinguéssiu per la dreta, ella seurà aquí, i llavors sortíssiu a plat a costat. Sisplau, sigueu breus, i ja, ella estarà cansada, no n'abusem, sisplau.